I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. About 2 months ago, President Trump issued an executive order declaring meatpacking plants were part of the country's critical infrastructure and its workers were essential. Outbreaks of coronavirus at these facilities have skyrocketed to more than 25,000 cases, including more than 90 deaths from COVID-19. That's according to the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting. And this is in spite of safety measures the company said they had instituted to keep their workers safe. While these companies warned about food shortages and breaks in the beef, pork, and poultry supply chain, they have been exporting these products to China. Our guest, New York Times reporter Michael Corkery, who's been covering the meat industry and the pandemic, reported yesterday that Senators Warren and Booker criticized Tyson, Cargill, Smithfield, and JBS for pressuring the Trump administration to keep their plants open to feed the American people while shipping their products overseas. Today on the show, we're going to take a look at our supply chain, especially under the pressures of COVID-19. And we begin with Michael Corkery. He has been investigating coronavirus outbreaks in the meatpacking industry and the ripple effect. Michael Corkery, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Why these safety measures, and companies have put in safety measures, why have they not been more effective?
Well, I think this goes to, the difficulty of, this virus in a place and a workplace that is as densely populated as a meatpacking plant where, thousands of workers. I mean, some of these plants have more than 3,000 workers in one facility. And, the nature of meat is, the pig comes in, it's slaughtered, it's put on an assembly line, and it's chopped up manually by people working side by side, I mean, literally shoulder by shoulder, cutting the meat, packaging it, and processing it, hundreds every minute, pieces of meat every minute. And with, even all the plexiglass barriers they've put in, all the masks that all the workers have, the gloves, the staggered break times, the nature of the work makes it very hard to protect these workers against a virus like COVID-19.
In fact, I was reading that I guess at some of these plants, the coronavirus, is it levels that we're seeing in places like prisons?
Yeah, it's pretty astounding. I mean, they're learning other things that may have made these meatpacking plants particularly susceptible. One of which is that, the virus seems to like cold, humid conditions. And that's exactly what a meat plant is. I mean, they have to, keep it cold to keep the meat fresh. It's humid. And there's a lot of blowing fans, again, that blows over the meat as it goes on the conveyor belt. And that air is just what, they believe, some of the epidemiologists that have looked at that believe that blowing air was just spreading virus everywhere. So again, it's part of the not many of us kind of are aware of just kind of exactly where our meat comes from, and we're learning a lot about that through this virus and these plants and just how vulnerable the workers are in many ways, even beyond the virus.
Well, let me ask you a linguistic question. Meatpacking plant, I've read about food processing facilities. There's the word slaughterhouse. What are we talking about when we talk about these facilities?
So, there's a couple of different, ways you can think about breaking down the, today's modern meat industry. It's extremely concentrated. So at the top of your show, you mentioned the big companies: Smithfield, Tyson, Cargill, JBS is another big one. They control an enormous amount of the meat supply. They have across the Midwest and across the U.S., but largely concentrated in the Midwest, have huge meat packing plants that also function as slaughterhouses. So they, if you think about it, it starts with, you know, let's say pigs. The pigs arrive by truck from the farm. They are killed. They're slaughtered. And then the carcass is then, you know, like I mentioned, brought along a conveyor belt and cut up into pieces and then packed as meat, as pieces of meat, pork chop, you know, the parts of the pig that eventually is made into bacon. So that's the packing part of it. And then some of those plants also process that meat into your hot dogs, your bacon, but many of them do not. And then there are separate processing plants that take the meat from the packing plant and turn it into those products that you, you know, processed meat that you see on your shelf.
You wrote an article back in April saying that the modern American slaughterhouse is not like the one depicted in Upton Sinclair's novel, The Jungle, but it is, as you describe, cold, you know, refrigerated assembly line, but also that it's staffed largely by union workers. And I think for many of us who have never been to one of these places, we think of them as largely immigrants and not necessarily unionized. Help us understand that.
Yeah, that was eye-opening to me too. I think you're right. I think the sense is that these are, you know, and they still are very vulnerable. But the idea that they're a lot of the plants, especially beef and pork, are unionized. The workers, it's upwards of 85%. Poultry is a little different. That has less unionization. Those plants tend to be smaller, but the big, you know, pork and beef plants are unionized. They are also, even though they're unionized and they have the protections of their union and a very aggressive union, the UFCW, they still are largely an immigrant workforce. They are many refugees that have been resettled from war-torn areas and have been brought out to the Midwest, largely to work in meatpacking plants. There are a lot of different cultures. I mean, there was one plant in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, that had 80 different dialects, you know, being spoken.
Wow. 80 different dialects.
I mean, it's just, it's incredible, the diversity. So if you talk to some of the workers or advocates that work with the workers, even though they are unionized, there is still, given their background, where they came from, there's still a reluctance to speak up if something is going wrong. There still is a fear of advocating for themselves if they are worried, whether it was COVID or whether they're not being paid right or whether it was other, you know, safety issues in the past. So even though they're unionized, they're still a vulnerable workforce. And in the early days of this pandemic, you really saw that play out. You know, there was just, you know, widespread fear, and on the part of the meatpacking plants, they were very slow to respond, even as the cases spiked. Now that's through many different industries, but here there was some really horrific stories of you know, just makeshift masks and people being told to work while they're sick, or at least think that they were being forced to do so. A lot of that has changed. I think the companies have caught on. But again, this has exposed just how vulnerable that workforce is. In this area.
Are these what we would consider to be good paying jobs if they're unionized jobs? So they have benefits. Obviously it's difficult work, but are these a ticket to the middle class?
You know, in some areas they are. And, you know, I've talked to some of the children of meatpacking workers who have, you know, are gone on to college and, you know, have, you know, their parents, you know, it's a very classic American story. Their parents made a pretty good living at the meatpacking plant, and allowed them to go on to college. And if they're unionized, their healthcare is pretty solid. But it is a brutal job. Manufacturing is tough. In general, meatpacking is really tough. I mean, it is, you get injured a lot. It's gory. It's, it's cold. It's just a very tough way to make a living. And going into this pandemic, the meatpacking plants, which were expanding their production, especially in pork, for getting ready for exports to China, where there's just huge demand for pork. The meatpacking plants actually had a hard time finding people to work in them because the economy had been relatively good and unemployment had been low, and they were scouring the country to try to find workers. Because
how about
it's
now?
Just, even though the pay is solid, it's just a tough, tough job.
I mentioned the fact that President Trump signed an executive order. This was on April 28th. He actually invoked the Defense Production Act, as I understand it. What did that actually mean? And I was reading that part of this, I guess, agreement shielded companies from lawsuits by workers who got ill or could have gotten ill by COVID.
Yeah. So what it meant, that executive order, which was extraordinary. I mean, there was no other industry where the Trump administration intervened to the extent that they did in meatpacking. And they did it because the meatpacking industry and the executives went public to warn about shortages, that they were saying what they were facing in those early days in April and in late March were all these local health departments across the Midwest, where their plants are located, were saying that they needed to shut down because of these outbreaks. And the meatpacking plants were saying, no way, we can't. We need to keep supplying food. And so they went to the Trump administration basically looking for the federal government to come in and supersede those local health departments that were trying to shut these places down. In some cases, they did end up shutting them down for a few weeks, but they needed to make sure it was only for a few weeks and they could restart again. And again, the story from the meat industry was the American public is not going to have pork. They're not going to have bacon on their shelves or hamburgers if you don't keep these plants open, even if there is COVID-19 cases. You, the federal government, need to keep us open and find a way to keep us open. So that was what that was about. In addition, as you mentioned, the liability waiver, which was, and if we stay open, our workers or their union can't come back and sue us if the workers get sick. And that was an important protection that they got.
Michael, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. I'm talking with New York Times reporter Michael Corkery. And he has been investigating coronavirus outbreaks in the meat packing industry and the ripple effect of those outbreaks, and joins us on Radio Times. We're spending the hour looking at where we get our food, what we eat, spending the first half of the show talking about the meat industry. We'll be talking more about farm workers in the second half of the show. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up your phone and call us at 1-888-477-9499. Questions, comments, stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, talking about what we eat, where we get our food. And again, our guest is New York Times reporter Michael Corkery. And again, excuse me, you can join the conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Michael, you talked about shortages. There were also stories a month or so ago of farmers having to dig up their fields or, frankly, kill all their pigs before sending them to the meatpacking factory in order to be slaughtered. But we have this very complicated food supply system, and when things go wrong, you can see how it kind of falls apart.
Yeah, it's extremely vulnerable and to a disruption like this. And it didn't take long for some of these plants. I mean, they're huge, but each one, is responsible for an inordinate amount of meat that's produced. So you shut one down for 2 weeks, and immediately the effects can be felt both for the consumer at the grocery store, or you know, at one point Wendy's, you know, 20% of their stores ran out of hamburgers. Or on the other end, for the farmers supplying the meatpacking plants, I mean, they are raising thousands and thousands of animals. And then there's another batch of thousands and thousands of animals right behind them. And if that, if there's any delay in bringing that the first group to be slaughtered, it backs up the whole system. And so when the delays and the shutdowns happened in April and in May at the meatpacking plants, you saw this really horrific and really tragic, you know, for the animals, for the farmers, outcome where they were having to kill, in this case, pigs, thousands of them at a time. I mean, there was one farmer that, you know, went and shot 1,000 pigs in a day.
Wow. Wow.
And buried them, or turned them into compost. And again, people say, well, they were going to be killed anyway. Well,
exactly.
Yes, but they were going to be turned into food. And
he was going to make some money off of them.
And they were going to make some money off of them. Now, they may get some assistance, financial assistance, for the loss. But again, you know, and then certainly there are people that have, you know, objections to eating meat. But farmers who do not have that objection feel an obligation that, I mean, that it's their job to supply food for people. That's why they're raising these animals. That's why they're taking them to slaughter. And when they go to waste, it's a real blow. And I talked to some of these farmers who had to do it, and it was devastating. And even though they'll probably be paid and be compensated, it was still a really awful thing for them to have to do that.
Well, now that the country is opening up, although we're seeing an increase in COVID-19 cases, that's a whole other issue, but we're seeing restaurants opening up, some hotels, schools obviously still closed and closed for the summer, and it's questionable whether they will open come the fall. But does that then open up the market for these meat suppliers?
Yes, and I think what we're learning is that, again, it was more complicated. The supply issue was more complicated than the executives at the meatpacking plants let on in April and May when the crisis was roaring. And I say that because I had just written a story about how even as they were warning that there was going to be shortages in America for the American consumer of meat, and that's why they had to stay open, there was also a record amount of the meat that was being produced was being shipped overseas in April, and it continued into May, predominantly to China. China's had an issue with pigs, and their pig population has been decimated by a swine flu a couple years ago. The trade war was lifted. It was going to be gangbusters for the American pork industry to export their meat over to China. They signed a lot of contracts heading into the pandemic. Turns out they honored a lot of those contracts right at the height of the COVID crisis. In a lot of these plants, a lot of meat was being shipped overseas, and so it's a little bit more complicated, it looks, in terms of, were we really running out of meat in America? Or what? I think there was some shortages, that for sure. I mean, there were some grocery stores that were running low. Wendy's definitely ran out of hamburgers, but just how much of a problem that was sort of is now in question.
Is there an appetite, I put that literally, for these plant-based meats, these fake meats that are, you know, I guess are designed in many ways to try to give the actual meat industry a bit of a run for its money?
Yeah, I think this is their moment. I mean, I think people, well, a couple things. One, seeing the vulnerability of the meat supply. You know, I think that really woke a lot of people up as to where their meat comes from. And two, you know, I mean, I think people who have you know, many people, and more people have issues with meat and mass-produced meat for a lot of different reasons and for many decades. But I think this opened up consumers' eyes. Those that were paying attention to what was going on in these meat plants, and to see who is packing that meat, and the worker that had to put their life at risk to do it, and how powerful this industry is, how much political clout it has, how concentrated it is. I think it only bolsters the case that plant-based meat has been making, that it's a good alternative to the big corporate meat interests.
Final question to you before we have to say goodbye to you. But do you think, I mean, once we get to the other side of this pandemic, and I'm not predicting when that will be, because clearly there are still serious problems, do you see, though, that there could be improvements in the meat supply system, whether it's about better safety at some of these plants, better pay perhaps for some of these workers, things like that, and food safety, of course?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think you're seeing, this is an industry that has both Democrats and Republicans have given a big pass to over the years, whether it's antitrust, whether it's safety. I think there is going to be more rigorous scrutiny of the meat industry. And I think the meat packers are going to have to respond because they care about their brands, many of them. And so I do think this could result, at least in the near term, in some better working conditions, and better meat supply. The only thing that I think is a long shot is it's extremely consolidated, and it's a few companies control much of the supply. That's a big part of why all of this was so problematic. I don't think that's going to change.
Let me squeeze in one more question. We're talking about COVID hotspots for some of these meat packing workers. Is the meat safe in spite of the fact that they're in plants that have the coronavirus?
That is what the FDA and the USDA, the Agriculture Department, has said, and the CDC has said countless times and continues to repeat that, as do the companies. We saw this weekend China blocked a shipment of chicken from a Tyson plant in Arkansas that had a big outbreak, saying it was worried about the contamination of the chicken. I think that is part of a bigger political drama related to the Chinese poultry industry and trade. Nonetheless, they raised the issue, prompting a whole nother assurances from federal regulators yesterday saying the food is safe. That's what the experts say. Yeah. That's what the regulators say. There has not been a case that has shown that it can be transferred from the meat to a person. So from what we know now, you cannot catch the virus from eating the meat that was produced in a place where there was COVID cases.
I'm going to do one more, only because Stephanie emailed us and she said, you mentioned in Sioux Falls there was a packing plant that employed speakers of 80 different languages. How does the company or union ensure there's language access for these workers so they understand the latest updates and information in their first language? Can you answer that, Michael?
Yeah, it's a great question. The union and the management they sort of said, look, we did fly, when they needed people to start socially distancing and get the word out about the virus, they said they put flyers up in all the different languages. But the union will, also admit it. You know, there are some serious language barriers and cultural barriers, and it can be hard to communicate, especially if something is fast moving. Even in the even just person to person talk. talking. I mean, these are loud plants. I mean, it's just, you know, there's just, I mean, think about that line of workers working shoulder to shoulder. I mean, you could take a 50 feet of that line and find 40 different languages of the people working there. And I think that really did contribute to some of the challenges of protecting workers and getting the information out about how they could protect themselves, you know, early on. And then you layer on top of that, these meatpacking plants with all these dialects are in communities in the Midwest that are rural or small cities, largely white, English speaking. That the healthcare workers are, you know, the hospitals they're going to also have those language barriers. So it made it really, really challenging place for COVID-19 to really take off. It made it especially challenging.
Well, Michael, I appreciate you joining us and getting our conversation started. Thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And he's a reporter for The New York Times. So who picks the fruits and vegetables that you eat? Chances are it's an immigrant. The country relies on millions of farm laborers, many of them undocumented, for this backbreaking work to keep the country fed. They're considered essential because of the critical role they play in the country's food supply system. They often work for low pay, few benefits, and because of living conditions are at greater risk for contracting COVID-19. We continue our conversation about what the pandemic has revealed about where we get our food, what we eat. And joining us is Megan Hurley. She is policy and advocate organizer at CUTA, the Farm Workers Support Committee. Megan Hurley, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Also with us is Desi Burnett, and she's statewide coordinator for MELAP, and that stands for Movement of Immigrant Leaders of Pennsylvania, and that's an immigrant workers advocacy organization. And Desi Burnett, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And again, to our listeners, to join our conversation, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Megan, let me begin with you. The weather is warm. Things are growing. So this is growing season here in the Delaware Valley. Could we feed ourselves if we didn't have immigrant labor?
Probably not. The majority of farm workers here in South Jersey are immigrants coming from Mexico and Central America, the Dominican Republic, Haiti, who come in every season and pick the food that we eat during the summer.
And do they come through a visa program, or these undocumented workers? How do they get here?
I think it's a mixture of both. So there's workers who can come in on temporary work visas to do farm work for the season. There's workers who live here permanently, who could be undocumented or documented, who do farm work. And there's also what we call sort of migrant farm workers who migrate according to the growing season. So we'll start in the south and migrate up towards the north, following the crops as they're ready to be picked and harvested. And many of those workers who migrate or who also live in our communities and do the farm work are undocumented immigrants. Mm-hmm.
Desi Burnett, let me turn to you, and let's focus on Pennsylvania. Megan was talking about New Jersey. How about for Pennsylvania? Where do our farm workers come from?
Hi, thank you for having me. And just to start, our organization is called MIRPA. It's the Movement of Immigrant Leaders in Pennsylvania. And we're a network of families across the state who fight for the human rights of everyone, regardless of immigration status. And our folks, you know, our members are all over the state, but mostly we have folks out in central Pennsylvania. And, you know, to your question, folks are from all over. You know, folks are from the Caribbean and from Mexico and from Central America. And, you know, I think, you know, one thing that's really important here in Pennsylvania in 2017, there was a report that came out from the Department of Agriculture that included some statistics actually about agricultural workers here. And in that report, it cited that there's about 65,000 what they call hired agricultural workers in Pennsylvania. And it's estimated that about 80% of those are, if not more, are immigrants.
Wow.
And of the folks who are hired in agriculture across the country, 1 in 2 are undocumented. So to your earlier question, you know, without unauthorized labor in this country, we don't produce food in America.
And just picking up on that, I mean, and these workers are considered essential because of the role that they play in our food supply system, Desi.
Yes, absolutely. And I think folks are really, you know, some folks are seeing that now because of the pandemic. You know, the reality is that it's the poor who have sustained our country during this pandemic, many of whom are holding down these jobs in the food, you know, in the food supply chain, and they remain working this whole time. And many, you know, are immigrants and many are undocumented. And I think one thing that's really important to share as well is that, you know, it's not just the workers, but, workers have families, they have children, they have folks at home doing the caring work, and entire communities. There are communities in our state, you know, that are agriculture communities, you know, everything, all the businesses, all the churches, all of the, you know, schooling is really, you know, based and rooted in being an agricultural community. And so, you know, I think that's one thing. When agriculture is impacted, it impacts everybody in these communities.
Let me pick up on that. But first, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about farm workers, farm laborers working in New Jersey and in Delaware. And as both of our guests said, many of them, most of them really immigrants, many of them undocumented. They are essential workers providing food for all of us. Megan Hurley is a policy and advocacy organizer at CATA. Desi Burnett, statewide coordinator for Movement of Immigrant Leaders of Pennsylvania. And again, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with our guests about the strengths and weaknesses of our food supply chain, especially as it relates to agricultural laborers who are at increased risk for catching coronavirus. Talking with Desi Burnett from Movement of Immigrant Leaders of Pennsylvania and Megan Hurley from CATA Farm Workers, talking about New Jersey and Pennsylvania. And again, you can pick up the phone and join our conversation. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. If I can go back to you, Megan, and I was reading about a number of farms in New Jersey where a sizable number of the laborers there, the farm workers there, had contracted coronavirus. Help us understand what's going on.
Sure. So as more workers have been coming, started working again and coming into the farm labor camps here in New Jersey, there has been increased testing of farm workers. The health clinics in the state, in North Jersey and in South Jersey, have worked with the New Jersey Department of Health to put together a testing program to test all farm workers in the state. And they've been making visits to farm workers on camps over the past month or so and testing workers. And there have been a couple of farms where the majority of workers have tested positive. Overall, I think the positive rate is around 11 to 17% of workers testing positive on the farms where they're testing, and they're also then working with farmers on what to do and how they can protect workers who have tested positive. Farm workers by nature are very vulnerable to catching the virus, and the virus can spread pretty quickly just because they live in very close quarters, they work in close quarters, they travel in close quarters, and that's sort of how it's always been. And so that's proving to be difficult right now to figure out how to be able to space people out in sort of the close quarters that they always find themselves in.
What are farm owners, I mean, people that own these farms, what are they doing to help their workers?
So about a month ago, the state of New Jersey issued some guidance, guidelines to help farmers understand what measures they should be taking to protect the health and safety of their workers during this time. So it's It provides for a lot of different protections, including masks and social distancing while working, and then also trying to space out living quarters. Most farm workers live in sort of dormitory-style housing with bunk beds very close together, no private space or personal space. And so the guidelines lay out how they can sort of separate out or should be spacing the bunks. They need to be providing adequate hand washing stations and hand sanitizer, and the equipment needed to be cleaning and sanitizing the equipment and the living spaces, and a lot of other safety measures.
So that's what they're supposed to, and is that happening? I mean, largely, is that happening?
Sure. So what we've been hearing, and CATA as an organization does outreach to farm workers on the farm camps where they're living, talking about issues of workers' rights and immigrant rights and all kinds of other things that are going on, and talking to workers about what they're going through right now with the coronavirus and the pandemic. And we're sort of hearing a mixed bag of things that are going on. I think some employers are implementing the guidelines and trying to do things to do everything that's listed and protecting their workers and providing them a safe space to live and work in. And in other places, that's not really happening. Workers aren't getting the equipment that they need or the masks that they need. The housing situation hasn't been changed. If we've heard in some places, if some workers have tested positive, other workers aren't being notified. So it seems to sort of be different ways of implementation or little implementation, depending on the farm. And that's mostly due to the fact that it's guidance. It's not mandatory. It's not law. It's not an executive order. So we've identified farm workers as essential, as highly vulnerable, but the steps haven't really been taken to make anything mandatory or to provide an executive order that would then sort of force these things to happen more quickly.
Desi Burnett, let me help us understand what's happening in Pennsylvania in terms of worker protections, trying to provide some kind of safety measures to protect against this virus.
Similar to Jersey that Megan just kind of went over, there were some guidelines that came out several weeks after the pandemic first hit. In our network, in our organization, we are part of something called the Driving PA Forward Coalition, which is an effort to change the law to allow folks to get a driver's license regardless of immigration status. And this is an effort that's been led by immigrants across the state since 2013. And many of the folks leading this effort are agricultural workers. And what we saw when the pandemic hit was things like folks were getting letters from their employers with the letterhead saying, I am an essential worker. And this is what folks were using to get to and from work safely. And when we had asked the governor's office, will there be protections for essential workers who right now don't have access to a driver's license because of immigration status to ensure they won't be arrested, they won't be separated from their families for doing this essential work. We still, we were never kind of given any kind of guidance or confirmation around that. So, our members have been working among many other human rights in our state around the effort for driver's licenses. And one thing that I think is really important to say for your listeners is that agricultural workers, by and large, are just made completely invisible in our country. And I think that it's great that this show is happening. I asked some of our members what they wanted these listeners to know, and I want to share it with folks if I can. So
please do.
One of our members who didn't want to use her name, she's a mother at a dairy worker in central Pennsylvania. She has a 40-minute commute to work every day in a town that has no public transportation. She does not have access to a driver's license. And she said, quote, that she wanted to share that the work that healthcare workers have done throughout this pandemic is so important, and there has been visibility about their work and efforts. And our work, too, is incredibly important. People don't see us or hear from us. We've been producing this whole time. We've been producing the food that you buy on the grocery shelf. People don't see it this way. If it wasn't for us and our labor, you wouldn't have anything to eat. And so she wanted to use a pseudonym as Maria. She has been working throughout this crisis producing milk for the people of our state. Another member named Azeen, who's a dairy worker in central Pennsylvania, he's been a leader in the struggle for driver's licenses since 2013 and is a rights promoter with MILPA. He cannot access a driver's license or health care, and he wanted people to know the following, quote, "I want people to know that those of us who work on farms, we don't have any health care. If we get sick or injured, we can't go see a doctor or get medicine. This is a major problem for agriculture workers, especially during the pandemic. Health care is a fundamental need." And so Azeen has been working throughout this crisis producing milk for the people of this state. And then I just have one more if time permits.
But, sure, go ahead.
Luis, who is a restaurant worker in Delaware County, who is part, you know, the restaurant, the folks who, you know, produce our food, milk, our food, but also pack, transport, serve, and deliver food are part of our community. And he said, quote, "My name is Luis and I am a waiter. And since the COVID pandemic hit, it has affected us so much. My wife has cancer and is high risk for contracting COVID-19 as her defenses are low because of chemotherapy and surgery. So with a shortage of, since the restaurant closed, as soon as the pandemic hit, his restaurant closed, the public where I work, I can only work now 1.5 days a week. That salary does not even allow me to buy the most basic products from the store for my family. If I had a driver's license, I could do things. Most importantly, I'd be able to buy food and, of course, take my wife to the hospital for her treatment. Mm-hmm. It is important that we unite in our communities, no matter what race or ethnicity, for this daily struggle we're facing. That's why we're here fighting, so that we can find solutions to meet our basic needs. So Luis has been working throughout this pandemic, preparing and delivering food. And I wanted to make sure that folks heard from the folks that we're talking about today.
Well, and I appreciate you doing that, because those are, first of all, very powerful stories, and they need to be told. And Megan, if I can go back to you, and I think one of the reasons we wanted to do this show about food is just the role that immigrant workers play and the role that undocumented immigrant workers play. And we have a country and a president, frankly, who wants to throw these people out, and yet so central to making sure that we get food on the table.
Yes, and also I think, Desi, it's great that you're sharing perspectives from your members. We've been gathering testimonies just like that from our members as well. And I think it's important to point out that a lot of workers, farm workers, but also other workers along the food chain in packing houses and food processing plants and warehouses are also immigrants and undocumented immigrants. And undocumented immigrants have been excluded from most benefits that have been provided to people during this time. They did not receive stimulus checks. Undocumented immigrants can't claim unemployment if they can't work. So a lot of families, maybe one spouse hasn't been able to work and one has. They haven't really been able to make up for that lost income. And also, we want to call these workers essential, but at the same time treat them as if they're expendable and not really show them that what it means to be to us that they are essential workers and sort of keeping the food system alive and putting the food on our tables during this time. They can't take paid leave. They can't work from home. They have to go out there and they have to be doing the work every day and putting themselves at risk because they're being called essential but not being recognized in that way.
Megan, John has a question. He's asking, how severe are these COVID-19 cases among farm workers? Are they working while they are sick? Can you speak to that?
I don't know specifically if workers are working while sick. I know that in the guidance that was given in New Jersey, I know there is a large number of farm workers who are testing positive, who are asymptomatic, and so the guidance allows for them to work sort of isolated from everybody else. We feel like if someone is sick, they should be given the time and the space to recover if that's what they want to do. But the guidance has sort of allowed for if workers who are asymptomatic want to keep working, they can do that, but they have to take certain precautions to isolate themselves from everyone else while working.
Desi Burnett, and I'm sure you have, both of you and Megan Hurley have heard this before, farm owners saying, look, I would, you know, I have to hire undocumented or even immigrant workers because native-born Americans don't want to do this work. Is that true, Desi?
No, that's not true. I think that, you know, there's a, you know, we can send some studies over. There's a very real labor supply shortage in many industries across the country. And I think that, you know, that's a, you know, that's really a way I feel like, I think that that is a way that there's, that poor people in our country are often pitted against each other. And I don't, you know, we don't necessarily subscribe to the fact that, you know, Americans who are poor, you know, are not wanting to work or do difficult work. I will say that agricultural work is very high skilled work. And, you know, the workers are often called low skilled labor in these jobs. And that couldn't be further from the truth. It's not easy to find people who know how to do this work. You know, we're not. In this country, we aren't raised with the same connection to agriculture as many other places, and I think it's really important for people to recognize just the skill and the that is involved in this work, and really move away from this idea that this is like low skilled work.
Megan, you want to add to that?
Yes, I agree with Desi. It can farm work, I mean, is skilled work. It's hard work. And it is mostly been taken on by immigrants and undocumented workers because also the system that it's the system of agricultural work has been created around exploiting cheap labor. And so really it's not about what, like Desi says, pitting low-income workers against each other. For these jobs, it's about looking to change the system that has sort of created some of the undesirable aspects of the job, including low pay, no overtime for farm workers, and some other things where it's not as desirable maybe as other work, even though all work is dignified work, and it's not about workers, low-skilled workers sort of saying that some are taking the jobs of others. It's about thinking about it should be seen as dignified work, and it should be recognized that way. And we need to sort of change the way that the system is working against workers who are in some of these jobs.
And we're almost out of time here. And I'm assuming consumers, Megan, have a role to play in choosing what they choose to buy.
Yes, definitely. You know, a lot of the work that Kata does is sort of pushing the food system to be better. You know, consumers can definitely play a role in advocating for farm workers and for food system workers, for policies that would protect them, that would raise, like raising the minimum wage, provide further protections for them, in their job places.
Well, we have to leave it there. And my thanks to both of you for the work that you do and for joining us on Radio Times. Megan Hurley, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. She's policy and advocate organizer at CATA. Desi Burnett, thank you very much as well. And thanks for sharing those stories.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And she's state coordinator for MILPA, and that's an immigrant worker advocacy organization. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.